Good morning, friends. If you've been with us this summer, you'll remember that we are in the stories of David. And so far, Saul has been chasing David all over the desert. Many, many, many chapters in 1 Samuel about Saul chasing David. And today we're going to cover quite a bit. We're going to cover 11 chapters. We're going to blitz through them and land on 2 Samuel 6. So I'm just going to give a brief overview, a highlight reel, really, for those 11 chapters that we're blitzing through. And then we're going to land on 2 Samuel chapter 6. So 1 Samuel chapter 26, David continues to be in hiding from Saul. This is a recurring theme. Saul brings 3,000 men to go after David. And then David has another chance to kill Saul, and he spares his life again. And he continues to claim that it's God's job to inflict justice on Saul, not David. Which is remarkable, right? Since Saul keeps trying to kill David. Chapter 7, David escapes to the land of the Philistines. David raids 3 settlements, leaving no person alive. So that happened. 1 Samuel 28, chapter 28, Philistines are warring against Saul. Saul inquires of the Lord, and the Lord does not answer him. So he seeks God. Saul seeks God and says, "What should I do?" And God is silent. So then Saul seeks a medium and conjures up Samuel, which is weird. If there's another recurring theme through these stories, it's weird, right? Anyway, it's weird. Samuel tells Saul through the medium that the Lord has torn Saul's kingdom and given it to David. And because Saul did not obey the voice of the Lord will give Israel and Saul into the hands of the Philistines. And tomorrow Saul and his sons shall be dead with Samuel. So that happens. Chapter 29, David returns to the land of the Philistines because the Philistines requested he not go into battle with them. Chapter 30, David avenges a raid and rescues his 2 wives, which were taken. David is generous with the spoils from the raid. Through these 11 chapters, we continually see David saying that justice is God's job, and he's generous with spoils, with the loot. Chapter 31, the Philistines kill all of Saul's sons, and Saul could see that he's going to die, and he asks his armor bearer, "Please kill me." And the armor bearer says, "No way, I can't do that." So Saul takes his sword, falls on it, and dies. And then his armor bearer does the same thing. So here we go. Saul's dead. 2 Samuel chapter 1. A man from Saul's camp comes and finds David and tells David about Saul dying and brings David Saul's crown and armlet. Recognizing, right, that this is now David's. David's the anointed one. He's going to take over the kingdom. And David mourns and weeps and fasts for Saul and his son Jonathan. Remember that David and Jonathan have a deep friendship. And David writes a lamentation saying, "Saul and Jonathan, beloved and lovely, in life and in death, they were not divided. They were swifter than eagles. They were stronger than lions." So even after everything that Saul has done to him, he eulogizes Saul in a beautiful way. 2 Samuel chapter 2, David asks God, "Where should he go?" And God says, go to Hebron. And so he goes to Hebron and he's anointed there. David rewards the people that buried Saul and cared for his body. 2 Samuel chapter 3, David claims that the Lord pays back the one who does wickedly in accordance with his wickedness. That is God's work, not ours. Chapter 4, David gets upset at his own men for killing a righteous man in his own house. Chapter 5, David is anointed king all over Israel. Jerusalem is made the capital. The Philistines are upset about this, and they seek to kill David. And David asks God, "Should I go after the Philistines?" And God tells him to go after the Philistines because the Lord shall deliver them into his hand. And we see another theme of David being dependent on God, seeking God for direction in each step, which leads us to 2 Samuel chapter 6, which is what we're going to unpack today. David gathers all of the chosen men of Israel. The text says about 30,000. And that's a hint of what's going to happen. 30,000 men is a lot of men. And they head to Baal Judah to get the Ark of the Covenant. The Ark has been in dormancy for 20 years, and all of a sudden David calls it up. And this is a marker and a pivotal point. David is now introducing into Israel a radical and bold innovation in the form of dynasty and royal city. With that dynasty comes bureaucracy, harem, and mercenary army, and all the necessary props for royal power, which will alienate all the old conservatives. So David appeals to Israel's most precious symbol, the Ark. And while David is moving the Ark, it sounds like one of the oxen drivers, well, the oxen shake the Ark, it's going to fall, and Uzzah, one of David's servants or men that was carrying the Ark, he reaches out to steady the Ark. And then it says in verse 7, the anger of the Lord was kindled against Uzzah, and God struck him there because he reached out his hand to the Ark, and he died there beside the Ark of God. I don't know what to do with that, since it says God struck him down. And in my opinion, he's helping steady it. I'm not God, though. And then it says David is angry because of God's outburst, and he's afraid of the Lord and saying, how can the Ark of the Lord come into my care, right? He's freaked out. He's like, how can I bring this thing into my care if God's going to strike down someone that is trying to help it out? I can't take this responsibility. So he takes the Ark to Obed's house, and he leaves it there. He's like, I can just imagine him, right? Like, I can't touch this, right? Will you just keep this for me? And the thing is, the Ark sits there in Obed's house for 3 months, and Obed's livestock and livelihood and family is blessed beyond measure. Blessing after blessing come to Obed and his family. And so after 3 months of that, David's like, okay, I'll take it back. So he goes back to Obed's house and he takes the Ark. I don't know what to do with God striking down Uzzah. However, it does exemplify the power of the Ark, the importance of the Ark, that it is to be revered and honored, and the Ark itself is sanctified. It's so sanctified no human hand can touch it. And we see David's anxiety over whether he can truly take the Ark into his care and whether it's safe to do so. I don't know about you, there have been times where I have a responsibility that I feel is divine, that is from God, and I'm not so sure I can take that responsibility on. The Ark articulates and embodies for old Israel the holy rule of Yahweh. David, on one hand, is making a radical departure from the old order and using the Ark as legitimization. He's legitimizing himself in his reign. The Ark is a powerful symbol. And I was thinking this week about the concept of branding, right? I think this is how we can relate it to our times right now. When we see a brand, we know what it is, right? I mean, you're like 2 years old when you know what that is. Or we know exactly what these are, what they stand for, what they represent, good, bad, otherwise, they conjure up. And maybe you even know this logo, right? That's the North Valley Friends Church people that Daryl sketched. That's our logo. When you see the logo, you know the brand. And I think that's similar to what the ark represented. Symbolically, the ark was the physical example of the relationship that existed between God and Israel. The ark was a piece of physical evidence that God was a faithful God and a God who could be trusted. Just not touched, I guess. The ark symbolized all the ways that God had been at work in Israel's life and a sign that the covenant had been honored. The coming of the ark is Yahweh's self-giving to David and to Israel's new political beginning. The community expresses gratitude for the self-giving and the presence of God. And they celebrate, it says later in the chapter, with communal meals, a cake of bread, portion of meat, and a cake of raisins. Everyone has cause to rejoice because life has started again. David breaks any sedate royal pose and dances without restraint before the ark and in the presence of the people. David embodies and legitimates the gratitude of his people, and this is a day to be remembered in Israel. Theologians tell us that there are four psalms written on this day. Psalm 68, 96, 105, and 106. So we're going to read Psalm 96. Oh, sing to the Lord a new song. Sing to the Lord, all the earth. Sing to the Lord, bless his name. Tell of his salvation from day to day. Declare his glory among the nations, his marvelous works among all the peoples. For great is the Lord and greatly to be praised. He is to be revered above all gods. For all the gods of the peoples are idols, but the Lord made the heavens. Honor and majesty are before God. Strength and beauty are in God's sanctuary. Ascribe to the Lord, O families of the peoples. Ascribe to the Lord glory and strength. Ascribe to the Lord the glory due his name. Bring an offering and come into his courts. Worship the Lord in holy splendor. Tremble before him, all the earth. Say among the nations, the Lord is king. The world is firmly established. It shall never be moved. He will judge the peoples with equity. Let the heavens be glad and let the earth rejoice. Let the sea roar and all that fills it. Let the field exult and everything in it. Then shall all the trees of the forest sing for joy before the Lord, for he is coming to judge the earth. He will judge the world with righteousness and the peoples with his truth. Amen. I don't know about you, but I can feel the hope and the expectation and the joy that's there, right? Like, this is a day of coming. I have ran all over the desert. I've been chased. I've done all this stuff. And this is a marker. This is the day that everything shifts. For a moment, I want to step aside and invite you into thinking, when have you ever felt like that? When have you ever felt that intense joy, hope, and expectation in your life? I'm not going to encourage you to say it out loud. Think in your own life when you have felt like this. And then I want you to think, how did you express that joy? We're going to get back. We're going to come around to that. Hold that. And so out of this exuberant place that I just read, David dances, and he dances in his skivvies. It says he kind of gets down to this linen cloth, which is apparently your skivvies. That's what the text says. So And David's not alone. Everyone is dancing in the streets. It's a celebration. And so, us as the readers reading this thousands of years later, we have questions. Because we see later on in the text, David's wife, Michal, does not approve of this at all. So we ask, is this just David being caught up in the moment? And this is appropriate joy and celebration? Is David being inappropriate? We know at the very least, his wife is super upset about this. According to theologian Walter Brueggemann, there's been much speculation about David's dance. On one extreme, it is suggested that David participated in a Canaanite ecstatic dance that became something of an orgy, and that's why Michal rebukes him. I'm giving you the extremes here of what the theologians say. I'm not saying this is what happened. And on the positive extreme, the dance is taken as legitimate liturgic dance, the bodily expression as proper worship. The narrative does not tell us of David's intention. All parties seem to join David in this except for Michal. And I think it's fair to ask, is Michal the voice of the old house? We have to remember, she's the daughter of Saul. Her dad has died. This is a long journey. She's got a lot of other layers other than just, oh, David's here bringing the ark. Let's party. Another theologian, Flanagan, suggests that this is the point of transition between the restraints of old tribal order and the possibilities of a new royal order. Michal, since she is the daughter of a king, knows how a king should act, and in contrast to David, who, in her opinion, acts unworthily and scandalous in Michael's eyes. And her words drip with sarcasm and anger, and David responds with, "It was before the Lord who chose me in place of your father and all his household to appoint me as prince over Israel, the people of the Lord, that I have danced before the Lord. I will make myself yet more contemptible than this, and I will be abased in my own eyes. But by the maids of whom you have spoken, by them I shall be held in honor." And Michal, the daughter of Saul, had no child to the day of her death. We could guess that Michal is barren. We could guess that David and Michal no longer share the same bed. But whatever case, Saul's lineage ends because Michael's the last remaining member of Saul's lineage. So David fights back, claiming that the Lord chose him, who appointed him, and David now dances before the Lord. He also gives some foreshadowing there, right? This is not the worst that's going to come to David. So we end chapter 6 with a marital argument, and the rest of Jerusalem is celebrating. We end chapter 6 with a shift in power and no more running around in the desert. So this week, this passage got me thinking about celebration and joy. It seems as though it is part of the integrity in our relationship with God to both acknowledge and express our gratitude, our joy, and our celebration, particularly in the ways that we are grateful to God. David has had a hard go of it. He was merciful to Saul. He was chased all around the desert. He was faithful to God's call on his life. He has been diligent. And we see in chapter 6, he is filled with joy and exuberance. Maybe there's a sense of arrival or finally this day is here. And sometimes, I don't know about you, might just be me, but sometimes I feel like our culture or myself have an easier time lamenting than I do celebrating. It feels especially poignant today. Why am I giving a sermon about celebrating when yesterday happened? And yet, There's something about our integrity in our relationship with God that we are called to both lament and praise. We are called to mourn and claim God as God over all. Sometimes when I'm feeling joyful or filled with joy or feel like celebrating the way God has been active and alive in my life, I worry about how to make others feel. If you're not having a similar experience, I worry about bragging or gloating or lording it over you. I don't know how to encourage us to both care about everyone around us and be disciplined and diligent in celebrating and praising God for the ways that God has worked in our life. Again, if we're going to have authenticity in lament, I think we're also called to have authenticity in celebrating as well. And it is good and right to stop and praise God for the very breath that we have. You won't be surprised that practicing gratitude also has psychological benefits. I did a quick Google. And Sue, you're really in my head because they have all these studies about, well, and blah, blah, blah. In 2012, the study showed this and the study showed that. And I'm thankful to Sue because she makes me think about the study and whether it was causal or anyway. I'm just going to tell you what the study said about the positive benefits of practicing gratitude. Real quick, they have 7. Gratitude opens the door to new relationships. That acknowledging other people's contributions can lead to new opportunities. 2, gratitude improves physical health. Grateful people experience fewer aches and pains, according to studies that maybe Sue's going to go look at later. Gratitude, 3, improves psychological health. Gratitude reduces a multitude of toxic emotions from envy and resentment to frustration and regret. 4, gratitude enhances empathy and reduces aggression. Grateful people are more likely to behave in a pro-social manner, even when others behave less kindly. 5, grateful people sleep better. 6, gratitude improves self-esteem. A 2014 study found that gratitude increases athletes' self-esteem, an essential component to optimal performance. 7, gratitude increases mental strength. For years, research has shown gratitude not only reduces stress, but it also plays a major role in overcoming trauma. And Psychology Today didn't include 8, but I will. As Christ followers, friends, gratitude towards God is a spiritual discipline that reorients us. It turns our posture towards God. It reminds us that God is God, we are not, and to be grateful for the very life and breath that we have. And sometimes that's like the only thing I can conjure up for being feeling grateful about. And sometimes being grateful may lead to dancing. So friends, as we go into waiting worship, I have 2 queries. If they're helpful, if they're not, you can just dismiss them and ask God to continue to sit with you and ask God if there's anything that you need to bring to any of us. If you have a message just for yourself, I ask you to sit and hold it and sit with it. If you have a message for someone else, I invite you to find that person and follow up with them. And if God gives you a message for all of us, I encourage you to stand so a microphone can be brought to you. Here are our queries for this morning. Have you ever been filled with holy exuberance? How do we share and show our gratitude to God? Do we hold back from expressing joy? And the second query, what might be a logo or a symbol of the way God has worked in your life? Let's listen together, friends.